Trigger warning. The following episode contains references to death, factual inaccuracies, several entitled people making light of all these things. If any of the aforementioned topics cause you discomfort, you may want to listen to a different episode.
Tulip Mania's running wild, brother.
I'm Adam.
Right, and then we'll sail over to the Americas, where treasure untold is held.
Yeah, like gold or the Fountain of Youth?
No, son. Flowers!
I'm Andy.
Non-existent tulips? I'll take 10. I'm Kelly.
Get out of the water, honey. I think I saw a peanut swim by. I'm Sean, and this is Acid Pop. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. This week and next week, we're trying something a little bit different. We're going to do our first two-parter episode on invasive species.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're going to be talking about invasive plants.
Like those stupid ferns in my house.
Yeah. I don't know how those got there. And next week, tune back when we will be talking about invasive species or invasive animals.
Also invasive species.
Yes. Even more invasive. So we'll start off with our etymology. Invasive comes from Latin, and that's in, meaning in.
Meaning not.
And videre, meaning go. So go into is to invade. So by the late 1500s, it had a connotation with violence. To invade was basically to storm in and start trouble.
Sure.
And plant is one of those words that hasn't really changed much. It comes from Latin planta, which means to sprout and is shorthand for vegetation.
Don't you want to planta?
Damn it, Adam took my joke. I was going to say it's their spinach-based soft drink.
And there is a sort of applicable phobia. Botanophobia is the fear of plants.
So move to the moon? I don't know.
It's a hard one to avoid. But yeah, this comes from Greek botane, which means grass or pasture, which is interesting. I thought that was just generic for plants, but apparently not.
Definitely not a good Seattle phobia.
Yeah. For sure.
I've seen ferns growing in the sewers.
Yeah. Adam and Andy, you guys have it easy.
I step outside, there's grass everywhere. You got to watch yourself.
Well, they legalized it not that long ago.
It's true.
So for our true false, what I'm going to do is I'm going to list a plant and then I'm going to list a country. And then you're going to guess if it is native to that country or not. So we'll start with the maple tree in Canada.
This seems like a trick question.
It does. It seems like something that like the Dutch and French brought over when they were invading and becoming like getting all the beaver furs, and then they just left and the maple took over Canada.
I'm going to say it's invasive.
See, I'm going to be contrarian and I'm going to say it was already there and it drove the French out.
Yeah.
They lost the French maple war.
They just can't win anything, can they?
I mean, when you think about the Canadian identity, it's sort of interesting. You know, we'll take some French Canadian and some Britishness and a little bit of Americanness. Yeah. And so it seems like the tree probably came from somewhere else.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that even if it did come from somewhere else, it's probably not really considered super invasive now. Like invasive seems to be something that's when a plant is growing there that you do not want growing there.
Well, Adam, once something is invades so much that it's the only thing left, then it's...
Well, yeah, it also has to do a lot with like displacing native species, but
yeah, there was a term for that I did not put in our quiz, so I'll just tell you now. But when a plant is invasive for long enough that it's just ever, as far as people are concerned, it's always been there, it becomes a naturalized plant.
Just gets grandfathered in.
Mm-hmm. So, Kelly, you're on the invasive side?
I am on the not native side.
Yeah, right. Same difference. Well, there are roughly 150 species of maple tree, and most of them are native to Eastern Asia.
Yeah.
However, there are 10 species of maple tree native to Canada.
Damn it.
Oh.
That's what I get for saying unkind things about Canadian identity. Canadians, you're great. I love you.
Just get these Canadian central ideas out of here. Centric.
Tumbleweed in America.
That one is definitely invasive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading about that. That's invasive.
It's true. The Cowboys brought it over on their pirate ships.
Rolling out of my spurs.
So tumbleweed is also known as Russian thistle, and it's an invasive species introduced to America in 1873. The seeds are thought to have arrived in contaminated flax seeds with Russian immigrants.
Curse you, Russia.
So strangely enough, when the gold rush was booming in 1849 and the Old West was hopping, there weren't any tumbleweeds. They came 20 years later.
Sounds like a paradise.
They're an anachronism?
Yeah.
It does really sound like a paradise. I don't know if anybody's ever been to a place with tumbleweeds, but if the wind starts and you have a fence, you no longer have a fence. Yeah. You have a fire pit.
It's now a slope of tumbleweeds. And tumbleweeds, they're not the benign things that you see rolling into things in the movies. Like, they're covered in thorns.
Yeah, just a rolling ball of awful and death.
Yeah, if one of those blew into me in a windstorm, I'd just probably lay down and die.
Wow, giving up pretty easy. That's how Russia wins.
So, the potato and Europe.
It was introduced to Europe. I guess you could consider it invasive.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's super invasive.
I thought that came from here. So, yeah, invasive.
Man, you guys are good at this. The word potato comes from a Spanish word, potata, given to the species that came back to Europe from Peru in the later half of the 1500s.
Hakuna Patata.
We had Johnny Appleseed and they had Potato Joe.
That's McKenzie.
Don't think that's what that dog did. But.
The dog just kept going into people's yards and digging holes and putting potatoes in them.
Hey, kids, eat your starches. That's what you said.
It's an angry dog holding a tuber.
I hear they're poisonous when they're green or something. Run!
Olives and the Mediterranean.
Olives have always been there. Because when the Great Flood happened and Noah's dove brought back the olive branch.
Yeah, that's proof.
It says it in the Bible. It's got to be true.
I mean, you got me with the maple thing in Canada. I'm going to say they are not invasive.
Yeah, I feel like I remember reading about like olive oil in like Rome. It's at least going back pretty far, so I'm going to say they're native.
Yeah, people weren't moving around before Rome.
It's true. Not if they wanted to live.
They know it's good for them.
Fossilized ancestors to the olive have been found all around the Mediterranean, so olives have been there a good long while.
But where were they before they were rocks?
In this digestive system of dinosaurs, I think.
Mm-hmm. Don't come in here with these half-cocked theories.
Haven't you ever seen those, like the dinosaurs and the fossil and he's holding a bottle of olive oil?
How about tulips and Holland?
Tulips were a gift to Holland that turned horribly wrong and took over their national identity.
It's like when you say that you like cats and then no one buys you anything but cat decorations for the rest of your life.
Like, hey, Mom, I like the game Monopoly. Oh, good.
You just really like Monopoly. I don't know enough about tulips or Holland. I'm going to say they're invasive.
Yeah, I mean, there was a craze. Like, it was a fad.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like to have something be a fad, it can't have been there forever. Mm. So I'm going to say invasive.
Yep, you guys got it. Tulips were originally discovered in Southern Europe and Central Asia. They worked their way north in the 1500s.
The tulips worked their way north, like of their own volition.
Yeah. Well, they were wearing their clogs. And
That's sort of how plants work. And that concludes our true false section.
We're so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys did very well. So this next part is kind of a short part, but basically I'm going to talk about some invasive species, and then I'm going to have you guys try and guess how they ended up getting where they got. So we'll start with the kudzu vine.
I just did a big report about this one for last semester.
Well, let's see if you know the answer.
I hope
so. The kudzu vine is a Japanese species that is estimated to cover 1 million acres of the American South. It coats everything in a blanket that sort of looks like if Tafiti from Moana ran her hands across it. So why is kudzu here?
Okay, it came with the kudzu, which was a Japanese cow zoo that was touring the South.
Cow regurgitation zoo.
And they fed it the vine, which has another name in Japanese, obviously. And then the cows pooped the seeds, and then the seeds grew. Kudzu vine.
All I know about it is that it spreads viciously quickly and grows like wild. And I don't remember it being here 100 years ago, so I think it's relatively recent.
Hmm.
How old are you, Kelly?
I remember 100 years ago.
I'm older than I look. I'm very well preserved.
Clean living.
I'm going to say it came over as like an ornamental plant. Like it was in gardens.
Yeah. Adam?
It was originally brought over during one of the World's Fairs in Philadelphia or Chicago, somewhere in there. But all of those ones were destroyed because they said, we don't want these to become invasive and cause a problem. And it was brought over again later on. Like they kept trying to get it sold off as an ornamental plant or like a livestock feed. And it didn't catch on until the Dust Bowl. And they said, this thing grows so damn fast, you can plant it in your dusty fields and they won't be dry and dusty anymore. So people started spreading them all over the place.
That is true. In the 1930s, the American government promoted the use of kudzu as a way to combat erosion in response to the Dust Bowl. Workers were paid $8 for every acre of kudzu that they planted.
It's just ridiculous.
By 1946, farmers had sort of lost control and it spread exponentially. By 1970, it was listed as a weed, and today it's a very expensive problem. It costs roughly $2,000 per acre to control, and power companies spend $1.5 million a year to repair power lines damaged by kudzu. It is estimated that kudzu grows at a rate of 2,500 acres a year and has been found as far north as Canada.
I feel like if you're one of those original kudzu planters and you're getting paid by the acre or whatever, you should get to collect on every acre it colonizes after that.
Well, I think like we're talking about the Dust Bowl, which is during the Depression. So they're like, hey, you want $8? Like, I will do anything.
Well, then like the railroad companies, like to prevent erosion around where they were building stuff, they would just toss a bunch of stuff out.
Yeah.
There's also been studies done for kudzu to treat alcoholism.
You just wrapped a man in vines and he cannot have alcohol.
He stuck his face full of kudzu vines. Look, no room for alcohol.
It's like magic. Calerpa taxifolia.
You made that up.
No.
It's a great word.
It is.
I went down to 7-Eleven and got myself a 27-ounce Calerpa.
It's a new summer flavor.
Is a species of algae known as killer algae. It grows prodigiously, choking out native plant species, and it is all but inedible to aquatic life. It is claimed to cover thousands of acres of the Mediterranean Sea. How did it get there?
It came in on a boat during World War II.
Yeah.
Like it was clinging to the sides of the boat and then just kind of...
I'm going to say it was on the bottom of Cleopatra's sandals and she dipped her feet into the Red Sea and then walked over to the Mediterranean.
Like you do. I'm going to say killer algae.
Killer algae.
I'm going to say it was introduced as some sort of fish control mechanism. There was some specific fish that feed us on algae that they were trying to deal with, and they did too well.
There's too many fish in this ocean. So this algae is very pretty, and it was discovered that it grows well in cold, low-light environments, so it became popular in aquariums. It's claimed that some of it escaped from the Oceanographic Museum of Monaco in 1984, while Jacques Cousteau was the director of the museum. In his book, Killer Algae, marine biologist Alexandre Mines claimed that not only did the algae escape from the museum, but that it was choking the Mediterranean Sea and killed up to half of the species of fish that live there.
Damn.
Yep. However, since then, studies have shown that the diversity of fish hasn't really changed all that much, and the algae may actually be helping biodiversity. Aquarius Jean Joubert claims that the killer algae story was exaggerated 100-fold.
Do you think this guy just really had a bone to pick with Jacques Cousteau?
Yeah, he both didn't like this algae or Cousteau. So
Jacques Cousteau, I did all of the sea research for years to make you think that I cared about it, but I wanted to kill all of the species with the algae I have developed.
The ocean would be so much easier to study with less species.
There's only one fish now. It is mad.
Let's French this up.
All right, so we're on to our terms. What is a bizarden?
This sounds like a German word.
A bizarden is when you go over to your friend's house and the dad has like framed Playboys all over the walls and stuff in his study. Yeah. And like a trophy for third place, but it just says jackin'.
Bizarden is the new catchphrase from The Big Bang Theory.
Bizarden.
I was sort of in Andy's camp, but I was picturing like those 70s conversation pits where they're having like the parties and everyone's in orange and really drunk and high on cocaine.
Yeah.
God, even this fire is made of shag carpet.
So Bizarden is a type of tulip that has red or purple petals with yellow or white streaks running through them.
Sounds neat.
Yep. That'll be important later. It's real neat. Trust me on that one.
How bizarre.
So what is a ruderal species?
Ruderal?
Mm-hmm.
You're just trying for words I can't say now.
Ruderal.
Rural.
It says hold your teeth together and let the words flow.
A ruderal species is a type of vine that grows specifically on the turning mechanisms for ships, causing them to crash.
A plant that is valued where it's growing.
I'm just going to stab in the dark here. I think it's a species that takes more resources than like expected. Like, just really intensive nutrients needed.
Yeah.
Takes only photos and leaves only footprints.
For a ruderal species, basically these plants are the first to pop up after some sort of disturbance, like a fire. So these plants are... They generate a lot of seeds and they grow really fast. And if an invasive species can spread further and grow faster, it takes over areas that were potentially inhabited by other species following the sudden change to the environment.
Well, that's how the tumbleweeds work around here is like you always see them pop up like where construction has happened and like torn everything up.
Mm-hmm. Or we recently had a mountainside catch fire twice during the winter. So I imagine that's just going to be a tumbleweed nightmare.
Recently, as in every year.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you can set your calendar.
No, seriously. Like one side of this mountain burned up and we were like, wow, that looks weird now. And luckily the other side burned up. Yeah. So now it's just one black mountain.
All even.
Yeah. I love symmetry. So what is allelopathy?
Ooh, I know this one.
Really?
Yeah.
Allelopathy is someone who can talk to Mia Jovovich with their mind.
That's allelopathy.
Multipass.
It's a Lilo Dallas multipathy.
That's what you get out of the aloe vera plant.
Yeah.
If I remember right, this is like the ability for one plant to in some way prevent another plant from growing next to it and preventing it from stealing its resources.
Yeah, it's more that it's a organism, which is usually a plant, that releases a chemical that affects other species around it. So, for example, the invasive common reed exudes acid from its roots, which kills anything else that's around.
So they're plant bullies.
Yeah, plant killers more.
The sagebrush that grows around here does that.
Mm-hmm.
It, like, the, there's a reason no other things grow around it a lot.
Because everything hates Nevada.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Told them to get out.
They said, hey, you want to try to dig me up? Oh, you hit a rock with your shovel? Oh.
Oh, I caught on fire.
Oh, crap, it's snowing and raining at the same time while on fire, and your shovel's broken? Damn.
Welcome to
Nevada. You'll never get rid of me.
And that concludes our acid pop quiz. So we'll start with what may be a worst-case scenario. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, Chinese and Japanese imported several varieties of chestnut trees to America. Some of the early ones were planted in New York and New Jersey. Unfortunately for America, these chestnut trees came with something a little extra, a fungus called Cryphonectria, which came to be known as the chestnut blight. Having co-evolved with this fungus for several thousand years, the Asian chestnut trees weren't hampered much by the fungus, but the American chestnut trees had absolutely no defense. No.
What is it with the Americas and getting hit, whether plants or people, by non-native viruses and fungi?
Well, they were in quarantine for a few thousand years.
We're a melting pot. Bring whatever you want. Oh, not that. Crap.
So in 1905, forester Herman Merkel found dozens of chestnut trees in the Bronx Zoo that had what looked like long wounds filled with an orange substance.
Oh, you never want to find that.
Yeah. These trees were dying and falling over, and Merkel conclusively showed that if you put some of the orange substance on a healthy tree, it would soon die.
Good stuff.
Yeah, he really didn't have a plan to deal with this problem. He just wanted to show what it does.
It is me, Herman Merkel. I'm here for your chestnut trees, and if you do not cooperate, I will be putting the orange stuff everywhere.
I've perfected killing your trees.
It's estimated that in the early 1900s, one in every four trees in the American Northeast was an American chestnut. And the nuts from these trees were a major staple for people at the time to get through winter. These trees were straight and hard, and their wood did not rot very easily, and so they were frequently used for poles, fences, and furniture. By 1940, the American chestnut was all but extinct, thanks to the chestnut blight.
Oh.
So are the Asian chestnuts edible if those ones are fine against the blight?
Yeah, they're good. They haven't spread, like, the Asian chestnuts don't spread as fast as the fungus that kills the American chestnuts.
So huffing to keep up.
Yeah.
We got a fungus that loves this wood. Would it eat the fence?
I don't know.
Maybe. Depends on if it likes live wood or dead wood. Yeah.
But there have been experiments to crossbreed American and Japanese chestnuts to make a resistant species to the chestnut blight. But there's really only a handful of American chestnuts left that are mostly clipped in seed banks and labs.
Isn't that how we got killer bees? We're going to end up with very angry trees.
Killer chestnuts.
we're gonna get those trees from Wizard of Oz, except they chuck chestnuts at you.
Or the Whomping Willows from Harry Potter.
So our next story is right up your alley, Adam. This is a profession that I'm sure you would have loved.
Is it gone now?
Yeah, mostly. So strange new plants have always been prized, but in the late 1700s, people could make their fortune by tromping off into the wilderness and bringing back previously unseen plants. There were a series of botanist adventurers at the time, ooh, though that sounds like an oxymoron.
Can I be the guy who carries your giant backpack?
So one such adventurer was John Fraser. Fraser would basically sail somewhere, spin around, and point, and then just go tromping off in whichever direction he was facing.
Playing his theme song. Honey, I hear the blues are calling.
Wherever he went, he would meticulously collect seeds and cuttings. In 1795, he found his way to Russia and impressed Empress Catherine with his strange and exotic plants.
It's a road.
She said to him the words that every adventurer hopes to hear, name your price. He did a brisk business there, and in 1797, he sold some plants to Tsar Paul I. Paul and Catherine basically told Fraser that they would buy anything he brought them. So in 1799, he set off towards America with his son. They had a grand adventure, and they went and moved down through America, set sail for Cuba, became shipwrecked, were rescued by a Spanish ship, dodged pirates throughout the Caribbean, and finally headed back towards Russia in 1805 with a ship full of amazing plants. Unfortunately for Fraser, in 1801, Paul I had been assassinated and replaced by Alexander I.
Oops.
Who had a no-plant policy.
In what I think is an incredibly bold move, Fraser basically hung around Moscow for a couple years, crying foul over the fact that he'd been promised money for bringing back all these plants. But personally, I wouldn't have tried this against a dictator who got what he got via assassination.
Just throwing exotic fruits at him.
I just like the fact that there are a couple of Russian kings and queens that were like, no, you don't understand. In Russia, we have no plant.
So amazingly, this did work in some small way, and he was paid 6,000 rubles eventually.
To shut up.
Yeah, basically, which is only about $3,000 in today's money. And that's not much for 6 years worth of work.
No.
It's not the end. It's the adventure.
Yeah. Right. So Fraser set out again to find more plants and make more money. Unfortunately, in 1810, he broke several ribs on a voyage. And from there, his health deteriorated until he died in 1811. He's still highly regarded, though, and several plants bear his name, including Fraser Magnolia, the Fraser St. John's Wort, which that plant has too many names, and most notably, the Fraser Fir.
I've never heard of any of them. He can't be that famous.
They named an entire sitcom after him, Adam.
So one historian said that Fraser brought more plants to the Kingdom of Britain than any other person. And that was the life of John Fraser.
An adventure botanist.
Yeah,
well, I thought he was going to be a botanist adventurer. Did he start as an adventurer and then become a botanist? Or
good question. I'm not sure which what you get started with.
Was easier than catching the animals.
Yeah,
yeah. He just his camp is full of cages, and they just have like flopped over plants in them.
Stay back and don't put your fingers in the cage.
You have the spray bottle.
Get back.
My next expedition, we're going to go find a city made of pure gold. Sorry, Yukon gold potatoes.
The Mashtex.
So our next story here, we're going to talk about the water hyacinth.
Sounds pretty.
Yeah. So this is a plant native to the Amazon, but it's found its way all around the world. One of the fastest growing plants alive, the water hyacinth can double its population in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Its seeds remain viable for up to 28 years.
Wow.
It can reproduce sexually and by cloning, and if it shows up, it's bad news for whatever body of water it's in. Their broad leaves block sunlight on the surface of the water, which strangles out other plants under the water, and as they decay, they oxidize in the water, decreasing the oxygen content, which strangles out fish and turtles.
What a nice flower.
The stagnant waters they create that are free of predators are basically ideal for breeding grounds of mosquitoes and underwater snails.
A plant.
Both mosquitoes and snails can carry parasitic worms.
Yeah, I just took a parasitology class last semester. I did not know how many bad things snails carried.
Yeah.
And Adam just handles those things all the time.
Yeah, I just got snails all over me.
I told you to take those off for the podcast. So this plant's pretty darn bad. And in 1884, at the World's Fair in New Orleans, the plant was given as a gift from visiting Japanese people.
Gift.
Here yeah. you go.
It's like, here, it's so pretty. The plant quickly spread from Louisiana to Florida, choking lakes and rivers and making it very difficult for boats to power their way through. Desperate to kill the horrible plant, the U.S. tried everything they could think of, including pouring crude oil all over the plants.
Well, good, good, yeah. I guess in the 1800s, we just had that to waste.
You know? We'll never need this stuff.
While this was bad for all the other life in the water, the water hyacinth didn't really seem to mind.
Oil resistant?
Yeah, apparently.
It made super cyborg crocodiles.
Made its leaves so supple.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so soft now. Thank you.
So in 1910, Congressman Robert Broussard had a bold plan that he felt could rid the South of the plant and relieve starvation throughout the country at the same time.
Light the oil lakes on fire.
We get rid of the South.
Nope.
Cut it off.
Bring in a whole bunch of hippopotamus.
Oh, no.
Yay.
Don't do this.
Our problems are finally at an end.
Oh, nope. Good. We can go to the lake now.
Known as the American Hippo Bill, Mr. Broussard argued that hippos would eat the plants and people would eat the hippos.
Well, I don't see any problems with this plan.
He had that last statement a little backwards, but...
You don't understand. People love hippo steak.
Well, he stated that cows, pigs, and chicken were all imported to America and that hippos were a source of food in Africa, so why not here too?
My God, his logic is airtight.
Look, we brought over other stuff. Why not bring over the hip?
Did he check to see whether the hippo even ate this plant?
I don't know.
sir, in your bill, you spelled hippo, H-I-P apostrophe A.
Hippo.
Sadly, the bill fell short of approval by one vote.
Oh, man. That would have been so exciting.
We would have had a non-existent South and a bunch of sentient hippos.
I wouldn't have had to go on deployments anywhere. We just would have been defending the inland from hippo attacks.
My God, they're back.
That's how close we came. And we're going to end today with the story of tulip mania. So in the early 1600s, Amsterdam was a major hub for the Dutch East Indian Company. And as such, the Netherlands got real rich real fast. There was a flourishing economy, and a lot of people wanted other people to know how rich they were. And at this time, a new, stunningly beautiful plant called the tulip was imported to Amsterdam, and people were captivated by their rich, deep colors.
In their defense, people are very pretty.
Yep, they are.
People were easily captivated at the time.
We don't have television.
Owning these flowers soon became a way to show how affluent you were, and they became highly prized. There were several different varieties of them, and they were all highly sought, but by far the most exquisite was the Bizarden, deep red and purple tulips with streaks of yellow and white. These were extremely delicate, and owning one showed that you were a person of immense resources.
What?
Yep.
Yeah, you had to have a maid just for the bizarreness.
Yeah, basically. It's like you could afford to buy this incredibly expensive plant, and then you could afford to take care of this sickly little plant.
Meanwhile, I buy a plant that's made of plastic and it dies.
So over the next 30 years, tulips became more and more valued, and hence more and more expensive. By 1634, a single tulip bulb could cost hundreds of guilder, and one guilder is roughly $14 today. So a bulb wow. could cost something like $4,000.
Not the Dutch economy, we're doing very well.
People were so eager to get bulbs that a future market had to be created where people would pay in the fall for a bulb that was going to bloom next spring.
Minority tulip report.
In 1635, 40 tulip bulbs sold for 100,000 guilder.
People are now buying the idea of tulips.
Yeah, basically.
It's like Bitcoin for flowers.
So this was $1.4 million. By 1636, tulip bulbs, or the prospect of tulip bulbs, could change hands 10 times in a day. To gain one of the two existing Semper Augustus bulbs, one man offered 12 acres of land, and a single bulb of the Viceroy sold for 2,500 guilders, or $35,000.
Hello, I'll give you 100 guilders and the story of Thumbelina for one tulip bulb.
Unfortunately, what gave these tulips their vivid stripes was a virus that came to be known as the tulip-breaking virus.
No!
It was deadly to man.
The fallibility of these tulips and their outrageous economic bubble they created caused the bottom to fall out of the tulip market in late 1636.
The tulip bubble.
Yep.
Gotta get your tulips warranty.
And thus, we got a surprisingly accurate model of the stock market over the cost of these beautiful, diseased flowers.
Huh.
And apparently, we never learned our lesson, because that was one of the earliest bubbles, but not even close to one of the last.
Surely there were bubbles before that.
Not so many,
like,
actually.
I'm going to sell you some non-existent tulips.
Like, how hypothetical do my tulips need to be to make money off of it?
Well, they need to be, you need to at least have some tulips to show off, so you can be like, look, I can produce tulips.
Oh, I got tulips.
You just need to know a guy who knows a guy who has tulips.
I'm not going to fork over the money for a sketch of a tulip. You need to show me a tulip.
Hey, buddy, you know, I go for my trench coat. Want to buy a bulb?
Yeah, I just have little baggies full of tulip pollen.
No, back in the day in Amsterdam, you just got high on weed and stared at your tulips.
A simpler time.
And that was the last of the stories that I had. Does anybody have any personal stories about invasive species of plants specifically?
See, and I'm trying to figure out whether or not it's a plant. I can't find any news articles. I read a news article the other day where we live next to Lake Tahoe, which is a famous lake.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say it like that? Lake Tahoe is a big deal.
People know about it for hundreds of miles.
Hey, it was in Mars Attacks.
Look, it's a nice lake.
It is a very pretty lake.
They're bringing the Army Corps of Engineers to the tune of $1.5 million to try to get rid of invasive species that are getting mucking up the clarity of the water.
Hmm.
Well, I know they've been worried about like some sort of mussel or clam or something up
Zebra
there for a long
mussels,
time.
Clam. Probably.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
Who put clams in the lake?
It comes in on boats. Like they get stuck in like the intakes and stuff.
Some guy with a bucket full of clams like, be free.
One of the big problems we have around here, and one of the big reasons for all our fires in the summer, is the cheatgrass.
Yeah.
Which I think is also a Russian thing, but I'm not exactly sure.
Very pretty when it blooms.
Is it? I don't think it blooms.
Doesn't it? Isn't that the purple stuff?
Well, no. That's something else.
There's something in Reno that blooms?
Down here, I'm not sure what they
are. It grows amongst the cheatgrass and turns the hills purple until they catch on fire.
Yeah, for a little while. Like right now, as we speak, the cheatgrass is already dying off and going to seed. And like as that happens, they turn this weird like it's like a dark maroon, sort of a rusty color. Mm-hmm. So like the hillsides, they go from green to sort of like a reddish purple for a while. And then they just are dry the rest of the year.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, even somebody driving by with fiery passions in their head will light the hill on fire.
Smoldering glares will set this thing off.
No snapping within 100 miles, please.
Like anytime there's a thunderstorm, I will go outside and be like, okay, let's look every, oh, there's the fire.
Well, last year was particularly bad. Like, I think we had a fire on just about every side of us at some point.
Yeah. My mom lives out there, and out where she lives, there's basically a rule that every year you have to clear 30 feet out from your property because that's meant to be a fire break so that if the hills around you catch on fire, with any luck, it won't burn your house down.
Yeah, I remember I texted you or something last year just seeing if your mom was, you know, not on fire.
Is your mom on fire?
Have you checked lately?
I've had tires popped by gigantic swarms of tumbleweed.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think the thorns are that bad.
Well, I hit like a cluster.
They just ganged up.
Well, it glommed onto my tire, and when I pulled it all off, the tire was flat.
I pulled my tire off with them.
Boink! Ah!
Trying to dislodge all these tumbleweeds with my pickaxe, swinging wildly at my tire.
How did this happen? Stupid tumbleweeds.
Who dented my bumper?
They're to blame.
Are blackberries invasive?
Yeah.
At least to Washington?
Yeah. I don't know where they started from, but yeah, blackberries are, they're the most delicious weed ever.
They're a nightmare.
They're pretty tasty.
Yeah, but
I know that you guys have a whole bunch right next to your condo. I used to be a janitor, and every summer we'd have to go out and clear out the blackberries in this one portion of area.
Yeah.
And every summer, the crazy lady I worked for would go, man, we really should dig these up. The only thing that grows here is blackberries. And we'd be like, yeah, we should probably do that. She's like, yeah, we could call in a backhoe. Or I could have you guys pull out blackberries by using leather gloves. I'll tell you what.
Oh, shoot.
Leather gloves don't stop blackberries.
They're supposed to keep bears away, Andy. And janitors.
Yeah. It definitely kept me away. Like, I'd find an excuse to be like, oh, man, it's getting like heat stroke. I got to go indoors.
Oh, sorry, boss. I got the vapors.
You know what works against blackberries?
Goats.
Goats. They rent goats around here, and they just... The second
I thought, Sean, I was going to say ghosts.
They set them loose on the blackberry hills, and just the goats just eat away at the blackberries and eat them down to a stump. I mean, they come back the next year, but yeah,
goats
goat rental.
All.
When I was doing my research on kudzu, that's actually one of the things they're using against kudzu as well.
Goats eat all.
I'm going to have a little bit to say about goats eating everything in our next episode.
Oh, but goats are so wonderful. Their eyes are weird.
Yeah, they are. They're great. I mean, that's like one of the things that makes them so great is, like, if you've got a plant that you don't want anymore, just unleash the goats.
Or a plant you do want anymore.
They eat the plant and turn into delicious cheese.
If that's not magic, I don't know what is.
Well, if nobody has any other personal stories, we'll move on to what are your morals worth? So I've got some pretty stringent rules here today.
And what are you going to tempt me with here?
How much?
You are a kudzu.
How much would I have to pay you to discover a new plant species? So here's the deal. You're going to walk in and we're going to agree to an amount. I will pay you that amount and you go find me a new plant species. I have a person on call that can instantaneously look at a plant and tell you if it has been discovered previously or not. But if you are incapable of finding a plant, or if you run out of money, you are then responsible for paying me back.
Mm. Ooh, so we're going to need to cover our travel fees and the like.
Yes. So how much is it going to take you to start tromping off into the wilderness like John Fraser?
Can we team up?
Well, if you team up, you'll both need to find a plant.
We need to find two plants, Andy. Yeah.
Adam, but for like $2 million, we could just go tromping off into the Congo.
See,
yeah.
That was going to be one of my cons against all of this is... It seems like the most likely place to find a new plant is going to be in the deep jungle somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the most likely places for us to die, Andy.
Yeah.
It's an adventure, Adam.
I don't want
with
parasites.
$2 million, we can hire two guides and a parasitologist.
But on that same coin, like, that's also where everybody else is going to be looking for new plants.
What's a parasitologist going to do, though? They're just going to be like, yep, you're infected.
I guess he can suck it out of the wound.
What if we just walk out into the desert where nobody's looking?
What if we promise James Cameron that we'll name it after him and he'll take his little submarine?
No deal.
No.
Part of the reason I'm going on this is to have the plant named after him.
Because I feel like the only way you're going to find new plants is underwater or in the deep jungle.
Underwater could work.
Or in space. If we get a lot of money going.
Nobody's looking there.
Well, no, Rick Moranis found one and it was bad.
Did he?
It's Audrey too.
Yeah,
oh, right.
I got it.
And he named it after that girl, so that one's taken.
I'm saying like $1 million is enough to hire like a whole crew. I can go into the jungle. I'm going to hire people to carry me on my palanquin.
Yeah.
I think you're going to want to raise your price.
I was going to say, nope. And then you're going to run out of money.
And owe him it back.
This is being carted around in his palanquin and like people constantly carting supplies to and from him.
Yeah, that's the thing you're going to have to weigh.
Is this a new plant, sir?
No. You didn't even look.
Definitely going to have a botanist on staff because I don't know what a new plant looks like.
Adam's got the degree.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I have a degree.
Here's the thing. I mean, even if you had a botanist, there, other than my special man that I keep on retainer, no botanist is going to be familiar with every plant in the world to be able to tell you.
Can I?
Yeah, that's a new one.
But at least they'd be familiar with the familiar ones. Maybe. I wouldn't be bringing you back like a maple tree.
No.
What is this? That's a peanut. Not only is it not a plant.
It's part of a plant.
I brought you this puppy.
Do I not know enough about peanuts?
No, peanuts are a species of mollusk, Adam.
Yeah. Oh, God.
That's what we're paying the Army Corps of Engineers to get out of Lake Tahoe.
A lie.
Swimming peanuts.
Just whole schools of peanuts.
Watch out. They'll bite your gonads.
See, the problem is I don't know like what would be a reasonable amount to go on an expedition like this.
Yeah. See, that's why I'm saying like $1 million.
I feel like people use more money in that on like actual expeditions.
I think do they? Too.
Like people, funding is a huge deal for these kind of things.
I'm starting at $5 million and wondering if that's enough.
Again, what Look, if you I, don't find one though?
Well, the more money I take, the more likely I am.
You're see, a gambler.
That's another reason I'm tempted to say like I'll just go out back and start looking in the mountains around here. And like I wouldn't necessarily need funding for that.
$5.
that's another way to look at it.
But then there's no risk.
Yeah.
Look, Kelly, I just watched an anime about an expedition to Antarctica and they only needed like $2 million.
I feel like I saw a statistic though about like the amount of undiscovered species in the rainforest. And it was
It's a lot.
It's a big number.
Yep.
How do they know how many undiscovered ones there are?
Because nobody wants to go there. You're going to get attacked by giant laser apes.
That's only in Africa.
I'm going to take the risk.
Yeah.
$6 million.
$6 million. Okay.
Wow. I'm going with the $1 million and hoping that I die in the Congo if I don't find one.
Leaving the debt to your poor wife.
No, she's coming with.
As long as I'm guaranteed naming rights. I think I'll go for free.
Oh, man. You're going to fund it yourself?
I mean,
Adam says he's going to wander the desert till he finds a plant.
Like, a species isn't like the rules aren't that super strict. Like, you can have this one kind of flower as long as it's like a separate population from another one. It grows in a different spot. You can call that a new species.
I get Adam's game here. He's going to go out and find two different types of sage, crossbreed them, and then present you with the new sage.
That could work.
It's tumble sage.
It's terrible.
It kills all the plants it rolls over.
It spreads plant poison everywhere.
Oh, damn it, honey. We got another flock of Adam sage back here.
It's self-immolating.
Yes, my legacy is complete. I bred them to have little like blimps that grow on them towards the end of the season.
So it's like a big dandelion puff at the end where they float away?
Yeah. They tumble through the sky.
Well, I am going to...
You're paying yourself at this point.
Yeah, yep.
You're my benefactor.
I'm going to take advantage of a bit of a loophole that I know about. So I'm going to say, let's call it $5,000. Because here's the thing. I know for a fact that most natural history museums have boxes and boxes of plants in their storerooms, a lot of which they don't even know where they came from. And they just literally haven't gotten around to cataloging them yet. So I'm just going to go to a big natural history museum, maybe the one in Chicago, and grab me out a big old box and bring it back and just show it to the guy. And he'll be like, oh yeah, that's a new one. And then I'll be done.
Why don't you get more money then?
Good job, sir. You saved you $5,000.
I don't know why the man was also your butler.
Like, ask for way more money and then like pretend to be in Africa.
Well, I'll just have a nice weekend in Chicago.
Very nice weekend.
Stealing a box of fossils or other plants.
I just need it for a bit. I'm sure they'll loan it to me.
And we'll name it after you. It'll be the Chicago Fern.
All right. Well, I think that's all we've got for this week. Tune in next time when we talk about invasive animal species.
Thanks to my co-hosts, and thank you so much for tuning in today. If you would like more information about today's episode, check out our website at acidpoppodcast.podbean.com. You can also find us on Twitter at acidpoppodcast and contact us at acidpoppodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us all the stars you can. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next week.
is a species of algebra.
It's that new math they're teaching kids.
I went outside and there was all sorts of X's and Y's and quadratic equations growing.
It's the world's deadliest math. At this point, people were so
At this point, people were eagles.